in Taysin are amongst those who have received funds. A city-based analyst and director of the Discourse Institute, Igla has described himself on Twitter, saying he now helps prevent people from getting their heads chopped off. Samuel Westrom, a British far-right activist involved in many Islamophobic groups, including the British Israel Coalition and Stand for Peace. He even co-founded the ludicrous and short-lived British Muslims for Israel. Gatestone Institute, which though it is based in New York, expends most of its energies fostering anti-Muslim hate in the UK and Europe. And that's not all. The forum has also supported the former leader of the English Defence League, Stephen Yaxley-Lennon, who prefers to go by the pseudonym Tommy Robinson. More on him later.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and he's now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest today is Dan Kovalik, who I spoke to earlier via Skype. Dan is an American lawyer and a human rights advocate who, between 2012 and 2023, taught international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. He's written extensively about international human rights and US foreign policy, and he's particularly critical of US foreign policy in relation to Palestine. He's delivered lectures on these subjects all over the world. Dan's also written several books, including his most recent, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, How the US is Orchestrating a Coup for Oil, which includes a foreword by the celebrated film director Oliver Stone. Welcome to the show. Well, I started by asking Dan if he could give us some sense of how the Middle East Forum fits into the wider American think tank world.
Yeah, honestly, it's not one of the more prominent ones, I would say. It is a conservative think tank, so it's more to the right of center than some others. It deals with Middle East issues, but from an American perspective. So it's all about American self-interest in the Middle East. And of course, when you say American self-interest, you also mean in the interest of Israel. And I think it's fair to say that it is has an anti-Islamic slant to it and has been accused of, you know, really slandering people that it disagrees with. Juan Coles, who's a Middle East expert, has said that about this group.
David, the Middle East Forum is core, isn't it, to US Islamophobia network. I wonder whether you could say a little bit more about how that's made up.
Well, in the US, there's a sort of core number of US think tanks which are engaged in pushing Islamophobia. The Gatestone Institute's one of them. We mentioned that in the film. The Middle East Forum, and a whole range of others. There's about eight or nine of them which are at the centre of the Islamophobic network. The David Horowitz Freedom Centre is another one of them. Mm. And they all share funders. Quite a lot of them were funded by the Gatestone Institute's main funder, Nina Rosenwald. And so they have a whole range of different funders which they usually share. And many of them, almost all of them, are, of course, Zionist funders. And this is one of the key ways in which we see the Zionist movement funds Islamophobia. Now, this is one of the key things which, the first time I said this, was it was very controversial. And
yes.
People say, this is ridiculous. How on earth can you say that Zionists are Islamophobic? Well, empirically speaking, most of the money which comes from Islamophobia and the network in the US comes from Zionists.
Interesting. Well, I then asked Dan why there are so many Islamophobic think tanks in the United States.
I mean, first of all, because there's money there. Let's face it. These think tanks exist for middle-class intellectuals to make a living thinking, right? So they get money by spouting the U.S. line on various issues, in this case, Middle East issues. And there's a lot of money to be had there because the U.S., again, it has a very active role in the Middle East. Most of our wars, I think it's fair to say, certainly since 9/11, have been in the Middle East. But even before that point, if you think about the Iraq War, the first Gulf War in 1990, for example, the second Gulf War as well, of course, the constant support for Israel against the Palestinian people, which has been, you know, going on since 1948.
David, we saw in the film there that the Middle East Forum has been engaged in interfering in Europe and indeed in British political life. I mean, why do you think we know so little about that?
Well, there is a history of US conservative think tanks intervening in Europe, and indeed specifically in the UK. There's a very early think tank, one of the very earliest European neoconservative think tanks, was funded from the US by the Heritage Foundation. So there's a history there. And of course, partly it relates to the history of CIA operations through front groups in Europe to try and undermine the left. But we know so little about it now because there is just no interest in the idea that the Americans and American think tanks are engaged in subverting British politics or indeed European politics. Mm. And there's even less interest in the idea that some of these people are and the organisations are Zionists. So there's just no interest and appetite to investigate this. But what we're seeing from the Middle East Forum, and there are other examples which we're not talking about today, but is the direction of Zionist money into Islamophobic organisations all across Europe and indeed in the UK who are stirring up hatred towards Muslims. And you know, you've got to ask the question, well, what on earth are they doing this for? Is it because there's a kind of generalised white disdain for Muslims? And of course, perhaps that's part of it. But there's a specific Zionist component to this and we should be focusing on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I asked Dan if he was aware of these transatlantic Islamophobia links.
No, I really wasn't until I was asked to look into this. I was not aware of it, but I'm not surprised. I mean, let's look at what's happening, for example, with the war in Ukraine and how much the U.S. is pushing that agenda of fighting Russia through Ukraine and prevailing upon its European allies to support that effort, even though that effort, and in particular the sanctions against Russia, which go hand in hand with that effort, are hurting the economies of Europe, right? So the U.S. has to do a lot of propagandizing to get support of the European people, really to even act against their own interests in supporting U.S. foreign policy aims, and that goes for the Middle East as well.
And David, I mean, how do the anti-Muslim groups funded by the Middle East Forum relate to wider Islamophobic currents in the United Kingdom?
So some of the groups that we've been talking about are obviously Islamophobic, and most people would be able to identify them as being Islamophobic. But there are, of course, other currents in the UK and indeed across Europe who are more elite in their sort of makeup. They tend to be think tanks as opposed to street movements, and they tend to operate mostly in the environs of Parliament, the European Parliament, say, or the British Parliament, or parliaments in other countries. So when you think about the Islamophobic think tanks in the UK, the Henry Jackson Society, Policy Exchange, Civitas and others, these are think tanks which are have a different sort of location to the street movements of Stephen Yaxley-Lennon and some of the other Islamophobic organisations. But there's no real distinction in terms of where they get the funding from. Almost all of them get funding from similar sources, quite often the same sources. Mm. And, of course, there's a specific Zionist component in the funding of all of these organisations. So it's very difficult to find, actually, key Islamophobic organisations in the UK, for example, which don't have Zionist funding. So there's a really interesting connection here which people don't understand and which you can see by just checking back on where the money comes from.
What other prominent right-wing figures across Europe have kind of got links then with the Zionists?
So, I mean, the Party for Freedom in the Netherlands, Geert Wilders, he's, of course, one of the key people. We mentioned there, Christine Tassin, the French people. There are many of the French Islamophobes that are funded by these kinds of networks. In the UK, people like Douglas Murray or Tommy Robinson or many others are also get money from across the Atlantic, as well as specifically from Zionist foundations in this country. So most of the people who you see who are engaged in Islamophobic activities in the UK, for example, will have money from some kind of a Zionist foundation, sometimes from the US and sometimes indeed from the UK.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's just pause the discussion there for a moment, as we've got another report now on the Middle East Forum's links to the far right, including its support for the notorious Stephen Yaxley-Lennon, otherwise known as Tommy Robinson.
Tommy Robinson is the poster boy for British Islamophobia. Embarrassed by his double-barreled, posh-sounding name, Stephen Yaxley Lennon, he adopted the nom de guerre Tommy Robinson. But of course, he was also supported directly by the Middle East Forum, the group at the center of the Islamophobia network in the US. The forum is ferociously Zionist and depends on the largesse of some of the largest Zionist foundations in the US. It supplied Yaxley Lennon with around $60,000 to support his legal defense team and demonstrations in the UK in 2018. Yaxley Lennon famously interviewed Robert Festenstein as Lawyer Rob, we've brought with us in one of his YouTube broadcasts. Festenstein was a representative of the Board of Deputies. He denied acting for Yaxley Lennon. Of course, in English law, everyone is entitled to legal counsel. But the Zionists do seem to make a habit of sympathizing with racism against Muslims. The Islamophobia has been visible, too visible it seems, at the Board of Deputies and indeed at the Jewish National Fund, an institution of ethnic cleansing in Palestine. Gary Mond was suspended from the Board of Deputies after referring to all civilization being at war with Islam. Samuel Hayek, chair of the UK Jewish National Fund, promoted the far-right Great Replacement Theory when he claimed that the white Christian majority in the UK is shrinking to a degree where there is a point it cannot protect itself anymore. The JNF was censored by the Board of Deputies for failing to dismiss Hayek. But is there a general problem of Islamophobia in the Zionist movement? Surely groups like the Community Security Trust, which says it combats racism and claims to oppose Islamophobia, are not guilty. They even directly supported the creation of Tell Mama, a group claiming to monitor anti-Muslim attacks. But scratch the surface and all is not well. The founder of the CST, the convicted fraudster Gerald Ronson, let his Islamophobia show in his memoir when he complained, possibly most dangerous of all is the rise of Muslim fundamentalism being stuffed down people's throats in the mosque and schools. And the CST itself has promoted conspiracy theories about how Muslims, or Islamists, as it prefers to call them, are responsible for the idea that Zionists are racist against Muslims. Islamophobia runs all the way through the Zionist movement. Zionists have proactively developed a wide range of Islamophobic concepts and ceaselessly promoted them to the far right. No wonder Tommy Robinson gets support from Zionist groups, and no wonder he was pictured smiling and toting a rifle as he stood beside an Israeli tank in the illegally occupied Golan Heights back in 2016.
David, I suspect many people will be really shocked, you know, by the Zionist support for someone like Stephen Yaxley Lennon. I mean, is there a wide constituency among Zionists for his politics? I mean, it seems really odd.
Well, it's a slightly complicated question because, of course, there are divisions within the Zionists about their orientation to Yaxley Lennon. So there are some who oppose him and have actually tried to suspend people from their organisations, the Board of Deputies, for example, because they've been too close to the kind of Islamophobic ideas espoused by Robinson, Yaxley Lennon. So there is that kind of division. There is, of course, a constituency on the far right of Zionism, which is fond of this stuff, you know, which is happy to hang out with Tommy Robinson, happy to be involved. There was an organisation set up which is supposed to be part of the English Defence League, called the Jewish Division of the English Defence League. And, of course, these are people who also are supporters of something called the Jewish Defence League, an illegal terrorist organisation in the US, which, of course, has been involved in a number of killings in the US and is therefore is designated as terrorist by the FBI. So there is that constituency. But then when you go back through the rest of the Zionist movement, even the ones who denounce Tommy Robinson, you find Islamophobic themes popping up. And an organisation like the Community Security Trust, which is mentioned there in the film, you know, the convicted fraudster, Gerald Ronson, is an Islamophobe, and he's clear in his memoirs. But even the stuff that they write on their website, this is an organisation which is dedicated to combating anti-Semitism, but which can't help itself from indulging in Islamophobic tropes and say, oh, well, the reason that people think that Zionists are Islamophobic is because of bad Muslims. Bad Muslims make these ideas up. Yes. And that's in itself a form of Islamophobia. So you find all the way through the Zionist movement that there is an anti-Muslim prejudice of one sort or another. Sure. And the reason for this is because they've got to say that the Palestinians are a problem partly because of their religion.
Oh, indeed. And, of course, and there's Tommy Robinson, a strider, an Israeli...
In the Golan Heights.
Yes, indeed, indeed. Well, anyway, I asked Dan what he thought the relationship is between the Zionists and the far right.
Yeah, well, it's a strong connection. I mean, people might find that odd, given that the far right also tends to be anti-Semitic, but that doesn't seem to bother many Zionists who are more concerned about defending Israel, right? I mean, Israel has now become a substitute, really, religion for the Zionists. I mean, that is, you know, the Zionist bread and butter. And so anything that they see as defending Israel, they will support, even if it is a far right wing group or country, you know, and that's been true for years. You know, the Israel was doubled down on supporting South African apartheid, in supporting the brutal Guatemalan military dictatorships, even after the U.S. Had to bow out from doing so. In fact, Israel's often stepped into these, supporting these right-wing concerns after the U.S. found it politically unable to do so. But all of that is in the interest or of supporting Israel, or what they think supports Israel. And again, that has led the Zionists down some very strange roads, even partnering with fascists, which is the truth of it. You know?
David, what do you make of these interventions from the Board of Deputies condemning virulent Islamophobia from some of their representatives and members?
Well, I mean, it's in one way, it's to be welcomed. I mean, they only do it on the most obvious cases, where these are people who really should be beyond the bounds of civilised debate. But, of course, the Board of Deputies is itself an organisation which is made up of some 202 organisations. Mm. Some of these are left-wing Zionist organisations, and some of them are not left-wing, if I can put it politely like that. Mm. And so all the way through these organisations, there is an Islamophobia and an anti-Palestinian racism. Even the most left-wing organisations, we've mentioned these organisations on this show before, like, for example, Yachad. Mm. This isn't a Zionist organisation, which is inherently anti-Palestinian. Yes. And also, of course, going along with the anti-Palestinian racism, tends to be a prejudice towards Muslims. Even if it's only to say, oh, well, Muslims are bad, Muslims hate Jews, and all these kind of effectively Islamophobic tropes, they're at home with all this stuff, and they don't even see it as being Islamophobic. They all, of course, use terms like Islamist, which is a racist term, to lump all Muslims together as having the wrong politics.
No, indeed. And, of course, many, I think, would argue that left-wing Zionism is actually an oxymoron, but
of course
that's for another day perhaps to discuss. But I asked Dan then if he thought there was a difference between anti-Muslim and anti-Palestinian racism.
Yeah, I do. I think there is a qualitative difference. I think, honestly, in the minds of most Americans, they don't even understand what Palestinians are and don't understand that many are Muslim, though, by the way, of course, as we know, many Palestinians are not Muslim. There's the Palestinian Christian. Palestine, of course, on Palestinian territory are the major sites of Christianity, Bethlehem, Nazareth. And that has to be considered. So there would never be a total overlap between anti-Islam and anti-Palestinian, because not all Palestinians are Islamic. But also the anti-Palestinian sentiment is a special sentiment because, again, it relates very directly to Israel's interest in gaining all of the Palestinian territory.
And finally, David, what's the connection, do you think, between Islamophobia and the Zionist movement then?
So, I mean, the Zionists have to be anti-Palestinian. They have to be able to justify turfing off 750,000 people from their land and not allowing them to come back. They have to justify it by saying they weren't really there, they went voluntarily, they were bad terrorists, we can't make peace with them, all the stuff that you hear from Zionists. But they also, of course, have to say, find other ways of demonising the Palestinians, and one of the ways in which they do it is to say, well, they they believe in this religion. It's, you know, it's not a good religion. It's not a religion of peace. Not, I mean, it says it's a religion of peace. And so they come up with all these Islamophobic tropes. And it's very, very common in the Zionist movement. And in fact, irreducibly, the Zionist movement has to be racist. And I would say, irreducibly, it has to be Islamophobic. Yeah,
well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. So let me thank our guest, Dan Kovalik, and of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis. So until then, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
A Zionist court has ordered the removal of Palestinian Negev village to build Jewish neighborhood. Residents of Ras Jaraba, which predates the fabricated regime of Israel, says that despite concerns for their future, they will fight the decision to the end. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote in this regard, the decision will affect 500 native people from Ras Jaraba village who have been left in a state of shock after the decision by the Be'er Sheva Magistrate Court recently. Residents of the village, which predates the establishment of the fabricated regime of Israel in 1948, say the news fell on them like a thunderbolt and was difficult to process. Musa al-Hawashle, a resident of Ras Jaraba, told Middle East Eye, young people have been calling me since the morning, telling me about their concerns for the future. We don't know where we will go. We have been here before the regime of Israel, and now we will be expelled from our homeland. The Ras Jaraba case began in 2019, when the Israel Land Authority, ILA, filed 10 eviction lawsuits against 127 residents of the village and their families. The government body argued that the presence of Ras Jaraba, which is unrecognized as an official village by the fabricated regime of Israel, hindered the expansion of the nearby city of Dimona. Dimona was built on land owned by the nomadic indigenous Palestinian tribe of Al-Hawashle, which also owns land in adjacent Ras Jaraba village. The fabricated regime of Israel wants to remove Ras Jaraba, an area of around 34 hectares, and replace it with a new neighborhood for Zionist citizens called Rotem, which will include thousands of housing units. Recently, a magistrate court ruled in favor of the Zionist regime and ordered the Palestinian families to leave the village they've lived in for generations, giving them a deadline of March 1, 2024. The families were also ordered to pay a sum of 117,000 shekels to cover legal expenses. Adala, the Haifa-based Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights, which is representing the Palestinian residents, said they will appeal against the decision. It argued that the court disregarded the residents' arguments in its judgment. Adala said in a statement, since the Nakba, the regime of Israel has employed a range of tools and policies to forcibly displace the Bedouin residents in the Naqab. Their livelihood has been confined to restricted areas and segregated townships, and they have been subjected to harsh living conditions with no regard for their basic needs and way of life. The forced displacement of Ras Jarabah residents to expand the Jewish city of Dimona, which was built on the residents' lands, serves as clear evidence that Israel is committing the crime of apartheid against its Palestinian citizens. Aboshla says that while residents will protest against the decision and fight it all the way in the courts, they have little hope in the current ultra-nationalist regime, which has placed the acceleration of Judaization of the Naqab at the heart of its guiding policy. Aboshla told Middle East Eye, "The new government is worse than the one before. They want to demolish the village to build a new neighborhood. The government has not offered alternative suggestions. It has been difficult to process and explain to the younger people. I worry about them, their future, and where they will go." According to Adala, Ras Jarabah residents suggested that their village be integrated into the newly planned part of Dimona, a request that was turned down. The village is one of around 30 unrecognized Palestinian villages in the Negev region of the Zionist regime's southern territory. Almost 100,000 Palestinians who held Israeli citizenship live in these unrecognized villages, which are denied any infrastructure or support from the regime of Israel government. There are no means of transportation, no roads, no schools, and Israeli authorities don't collaborate with their local leadership. Palestinian citizens of the occupied territories are the descendants of the native population, which was violently displaced by Zionist militias during the creation of the fabricated regime of Israel in 1948. At least 300,000 Palestinians live in the Negev region and say that Israeli regime authorities have attempted to force them out and destroy their nomadic way of life for decades through various tactics. These include confiscation of lands from native Palestinians and turning landowners into tenants. Additionally, the Israeli regime government has been accused of preventing the expansion of Palestinian villages and encircling them with new Zionist Jewish settlements. Youssef Al-Atwana, a Palestinian member of the Israeli parliament with the Hadash Tal coalition, told Middle East Eye, "The goal of the Israeli government is to take control over Arab land in the Naqab and to expel entire communities from the land. This has been ongoing since 1948, and some families have been displaced twice." The MP said he's collaborating with the Negev-based committee to organize a large-scale protest over the expulsions and projects taking place. He said, "People are very angry over the racism that is taking place. But despite the difficult circumstances, fines and displacements, people are remaining steadfast and strong," he added, predicting that the recent court decision will likely inflame tensions in the Negev. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency reported a Palestinian citizen was wounded in the hand on July 28 after Israeli regime settlers attacked his vehicle near the village of Al-Mughayr, to the east of Ramallah, in the occupied West Bank, local sources told Wafa. A number of Zionist settlers attacked the vehicle of a citizen from the town of Beitounia near the village of Al-Mughayr, injuring him in the hand, the sources added. The vehicle's windshield was shattered as a result of the attack, while the man was taken Al-Mughayr Medical Center for treatment. Zionist settler violence against Palestinians and their property is commonplace in the West Bank and is backed and supported by the hard-right Israeli government. There are over 700,000 Zionist settlers illegally occupying portions of the West Bank in violation of international law and established norms prohibiting the relocation of the occupying power civil population to the land of the occupied.
Economic divide.
The U.S. is doing all that it can when it comes to the war in Ukraine, but its actions are not limited to just the battlefield or military supplies for Ukraine. It is also busy working on limiting Russia's income by enticing Russian allies and countries that do business with it. How it is doing that is the topic of this edition of Economic Divide. Some of the headlines coming up in today's program. The U.S. is squeezing Russia's revenues. It wants to lure countries off Russia. Two of the countries that it has done that with, India and Turkey. The U.S. bait has been loans or military equipment. Has it worked? Well, to some degree. That's coming up. Next up, U.S. sanctions. Countries that trade with Russia obviously are being sanctioned, but sanctions are actually not only hurting those economies, but also European countries, including the U.S. in some sense. U.S. profiting by replacing Russia as energy supplier. Next, are the U.S. goals successful? That is key. EU countries, well, they're still buying Russian oil. And the U.S. is still trading with Russia, as a matter of fact. But these actions are leading to a weakening world economy.
As the war between the U.S.-led bloc and Russia heats up in Ukraine, Washington and Moscow are scrambling to find allies in different parts of the world. One of those areas of intense rivalry between the U.S. and Russia has been the East Asia region and China in particular. Russia hit with wide-ranging international sanctions, it has turned to the world's second-largest economy, China. Trade between the two countries reached $93.8 billion for the first half of this year, which is about a 40% rise from last year. In particular, semiconductors are a prized Chinese export, as integrated circuit shipments to Russia were valued at $179 million in 2022, against just $74 million in 2021. Rising trade ties between China and Russia has angered the U.S. Earlier in July, the U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen concluded a four-day trip to China aimed at rebuilding bridges between the two countries. The U.S. appears to be encouraging China to move away from Russia through trade incentives. India is also a notable example in this regard.
The U.S. has been pushing India to decrease its business ties with Russia. Both India and Russia are members of the BRICS nations. Moscow has since leapfrogged to become India's leading source of crude oil, accounting for about 40% of India's crude imports. June marked the 10th consecutive month-on-month increase in India's imports of Russian crude. By pressuring India, the U.S. is also trying to create cracks with that bloc.
Be it Russia or be it the U.S. stand against Russia or Europe stand in the Russia against Russia, are all being dictated by their own commercial interests. So we are saying that we will let our own commercial interests guide us how we react to this crisis.
Another country that the U.S. is giving incentives in order for it to move away from Russia is Turkey. The U.S. has agreed to a $13.1 billion loan from the IMF for Turkey to remove its opposition to Sweden joining NATO. Time now to look at some social media posts and online entries. First up, the U.S. dangles F-35 to lure India away from Russia. It said the U.S. is seeking to woo India away from Russia by dangling its most advanced combat aircraft, playing on India's need to keep pace with rival Pakistan and China's rapidly modernizing air forces. Now, we take a look at another entry of the same title, U.S. dangles F-35 to lure India away from Russia, of which this is what this said. The premise of U.S. arms sales is that clients join a U.S.-dominated logistics train in exchange for maintenance, technical support, better pricing, and more options for purchases, but in effect, surrender large parts of their foreign and defense policy to U.S. interests. So there you have it in black and white. Next up, website U.S. to offer loans to lure developing countries away from Chinese telecom gear. This is another strategy that the U.S. is using, in this case for China. Washington aims to entice countries in Africa and elsewhere away from Huawei and ZTE. It said the offer of financial assistance represents a new tool that Washington is deploying as it broadens the tech Cold War with China. It said U.S. aid, which is known for providing food assistance, then technology, has been assigned to persuade developing countries that using Huawei and ZTE core is a bad idea. And finally, China is trading more with Russia, but so are many U.S. allies and partners. Since early 2022, non-aligned countries and even some European Union members are trading with Russia. All right, those were the topics that we picked from different social media posts and websites. Let me introduce our guest for our first segment of the Q&A. Joining us is Robson Kardec Valdez from the Foundation of Economics and Statistics, who joins us. Robson, welcome to Economic Divide. So, first question, the U.S. is pushing hard to wean off countries from Russia. It's the topic of our program. We, in this question, want to pose to you India from the BRICS grouping of countries, in which obviously the oil purchases from Russia is at an all-time high. But how successful is the U.S. in that regard, especially when it comes to India and its oil purchases from Russia?
Well, you see, after the war in Ukraine, the U.S. and its allies realized that the BRICS have a great deal of influence on the countries of the Global South. This influence has to do with the individual leadership of these countries in each of their respective areas of influence in Asia, Central Asia, Africa, Latin America. And when these countries promote a joint international agenda, this influence seems to be greater on a global scale, and this has greatly bothered the United States, especially in a context where the West has been trying to weaken Russia through economic sanctions. So I don't believe that the U.S. pressure on the other BRICS members like India, Brazil, South Africa will work. I believe that that's going to take some time to have that result in the U.S. perspective. We have to remember.
All right, thank you for that. Let me bring our next guest in for this first Q&A. Matthew Ehrich joins us. He's a senior fellow at the American University in Moscow and editor-in-chief of the Canadian Patriot Review. Matthew Ehrich, welcome to Economic Divide. Let's see over here. We want to use another example in this question to you, and that is Turkey, where it agreed to withdraw its opposition to Sweden joining NATO.
And it is said that it was because the U.S. actually approved a $13.1 billion loan from the IMF in order to convince Turkey to do that. This obviously is going to expand NATO's expansion against Russia. How do you think the U.S. is approaching the matter when it came to this case? Did it involve threats as well as the rewards?
Well, of course, there are many things that we don't know fully. It was a surprise that Turkey, Erdogan relented on his opposition to Sweden's entry. Sweden didn't give too much in return. And, you know, the things that we're told have persuaded Erdogan to make this move by, and I hear I'm referring to the selling of Russian F-16s. The $13 billion loan that was given. I mean, obviously these are reality, like real things that were done, but were these sufficient to persuade Turkey to do such a thing as what we've seen, permitting Sweden now to become a member of NATO?
It's time now for the Info News section of the program. Our first topic that we covered, we thought important, is corruption in Ukraine. This has been mentioned more recently than before, even though the whole country has been plagued by this even before the war, even prior to that. Now, this particular entry that we looked at said Europe's black hole. How much of the more than $185 billion given by the West to Ukraine has been stolen? Using their words there, in terms of that particular word, stolen. It went on to say, one example, Ukraine's military had agreed to pay inflated prices for food meant for its troops. Our take on this, as the U.S. and its allies are throwing money at Ukraine, EU countries, and even the U.S. itself, are dealing with the cost of living crisis. Only 60% of Americans who back Democrats and 34% of those who favor Republicans are willing to tolerate inflation for the sake of providing further assistance to Kiev. Next up, something that the EU should be worried about, it's about their supplies of gas. Now, the IAE has said that the EU faces a winter gas shortage risk. Went on to say full storage sites are no guarantee against volatility. Mark my words, folks, this is going to be a big problem for the EU coming up this winter. They may look good right now in terms of what they have, but come this winter, you will see how they will suffer if this war continues. All right, moving to the next topic concerns the economy of the island nation of Cuba, where as Cuba's private sector roars back, choices and inequality have risen. Even as more small businesses have popped up across the island, some simply can't afford what's on sale. We looked at this through Fidel Castro, the late Fidel Castro's eyes, in which he said capitalism must be uprooted, parasitism must be uprooted, the exploitation of man must be uprooted. The words by the late Fidel Castro. And finally, this was very interesting, our last entry, which concerns Japan and the pay that the workers in that country receive. It said Japan's workers get rare pay bump after decades without a raise. The salary increases were 1% per year, earning only three quarters as much as developed country peers over 30 years. So much for a country that has one of the highest GDPs in the world. And before we let go of the news section, we are looking at a special investigation. This is something that we figured is important to look at and maybe have a program where it concerns oil pricing without dollars. Is it possible? How much does it matter whether oil is priced in dollars is our focus, and also what the alternatives are and how vulnerable is dollar pricing. In addition, who would suffer or gain most if dollars cease to be the automatic medium for oil exchange? So that's a special investigation that we will be conducting that has started already. Well, those were the topics for our InfoNews section. It's time now for the in-depth section of the program. For the U.S. to squeeze Russia's income,
It needs to zoom in on countries that are doing business with Russia to stop the cash lifeline. Whether the U.S. can actually do that or not is a whole other story. First, let's see who the U.S. is actually zooming in on. These are the top countries that we have, and in the number one position is India, which has experienced an almost 250% growth in total trade with Russia. Now, what's interesting to note here is that everyone would have thought China should be in the number one spot. But take a look at where China stands. China, which is pretty interesting, it's in seventh place based on the top nine countries that are doing business, and that is a surprise. All right, next, let's take a look at how Russia has generated its revenues in terms of the focus of the sector of energy where we came in was mineral fuels, and most notably, that is crude oil. Now, when the Ukraine war started, this is where it shot up in terms of the sales that happened. And we're looking at India again coming in on top of China. China does not rank on top. Since Russia's invasion, India's imports has grown nearly tenfold from around $4.7 billion in the year prior to Russia's invasion to around $41 billion in the year following. While Chinese imports have also grown by around 55%, this is largely in line with the trend line growth that came before the conflict. All right, this is very interesting in terms of what is called the Druzhba pipeline, which feeds EU refineries. Now, if India's imports have grown tenfold, then the immediate question is, why does it need all that oil? The answer is not a clear-cut one, but one scenario that has been proven to be true is that oil that India is purchasing is making its way back to European shores through the use of intermediaries. There's been a 15% increase in terms of the monthly flow of oil. And where is that being done through? The Druzhba pipeline. If we can zoom in on this in terms of what the Druzhba pipeline is, it flows from Russia, it goes through Ukraine, and then it fans out into Europe. And this is where that 15% increase in monthly flow is coming. What does that spell? Well, it spells that the oil is making it back to European shores. That's pretty much what that means. And if you don't really believe this scenario or think it's hypothetical, you don't need to look that far. Let's go on to the next screen in order for me to prove what I'm saying is actually accurate. Here you have Joseph Borrell, the EU foreign policy chief, who says, if Indian refiners are selling, that is because European companies are buying directly or through an intermediary. Okay? So there you have. That's the proof. India, of course, has shot back, and it has says, the India's oil minister has said, as a sovereign country, India is free to import or export goods and commodities within the terms of international law. Of course, India is entitled to say that because India has bought the oil already, so it can resell it to whomever that it wants, at least based on international law. Not something that obviously Europe would like to hear. All right, let's find out what our guests think about this. Let me reintroduce him. Matthew Ehret rejoins us. He's a senior fellow at the American University in Moscow. Matthew Ehret, welcome back to Economic Divide. We want to take a look at India's role when it comes to the purchases of Russian oil. Reports that I just indicated that it's making its way back to Europe. This is while the U.S. is obviously trying to do its best to wean off India, not only from Russia as a whole, but in terms of purchasing oil. What do you think is going on here?
There have been a much greater integration and cooperation of a lot of the Eurasian economies and allies of Russia around the world, India being a major one whose imports of Russian oil have quadrupled since last year, I think now amounting to approximately $46 billion of imports. That's a fourfold increase, and new mechanisms have been created to allow for the settlement of payments between of transactions in rupees and ruples, as well as broader many, many other points of physical economic integration with Russia and India have occurred. India has, with China and many other countries, have far outpaced any expectations to purchase all of the oil revenues and the oil that Russia is no longer selling directly to Europe. But, you know, as we're discovering, many of those European countries are still receiving Russian oil, but simply now being purchased through India and other third parties.
All right, thank you for that. Let me bring back Robson Cardoc Valdez from the Foundation of Economics and Statistics to see what he thinks. Robson Cardoc Valdez, welcome back. I'd like to take a look at the sanctions that the U.S. is imposing in numerous cases against other countries aligned with Russia, or even not aligned for that matter. I mean, isn't this something that is an overextension of sanctions, which could also harm other countries' economies, like in the case of Russian gas and oil?
Yes, I believe so. That's definitely about the excessive use of sanctions. The academic literature has already proven that economic sanctions, the use of economic sanctions, has little or no effect on the behavior of governments and only harms the population of these countries. So, like I said before, the U.S. will try everything to beat Russia in their war on Ukrainian soil, and they want a positive result from that big issue, because they don't want to start the, you know, the next year to go on a presidential election race at the same time they are involved in a war in Ukraine.
A separate scene of rivalry is the Eurasia region, where Russia, Iran, and China are trying to create a united axis against the U.S.-led bloc. Both Russia and Iran recognize China's enormous hard and soft power, and both seek to lure the world's second richest country into a closer embrace. Economically, that process is well underway. Washington could split the coalition by reconciling with one or more of its members. That explains the reason for Washington's more conciliatory tone toward China and its apparent engagement in third-channel dialogue with Iran.
Last week's visit served as a step forward in putting our relationship on a surer footing and establishing a resilient and productive channel of communication. There's much more work to do, but I believe this trip was an important start. I'm eager to build on the groundwork that we laid in Beijing to mobilize further action.
The U.S. and Russia are also vying to have allies in Africa. In the past 3 years, the U.S. government has closed more than 900 deals valued at $22 billion across 47 African countries in trade and investment. Moscow is also planning closer ties with the African continent. Political relations between Russia and Africa underwent a reset after the 2019 Russia-Africa summit in Sochi. 70% of Russia's Africa trade is concentrated within the four economies of Algeria, Egypt, Morocco, and South Africa. These countries are the cornerstone of Russia's Africa policy and are generally recognized to become important economies by 2050. Russia is planning to radically change that by expanding its trade partners in the continent. The U.S. is also using sanctions and threats in order to lure them away from Russia. The overuse of sanctions by the U.S. could further hurt the economies of U.S. allies as well. Europe has been badly hit after it was forced by the U.S. to cut its energy deals with Russia.
Hello, welcome to the Quick Take section. Mahdi Abbasian is off reporting. U.S. efforts to lure countries away from Russia with the aim of weakening it is now common knowledge. Looking closely, the U.S. focus has been the BRICS members, and one of those countries is India. The U.S. has offered India drones to lure it away from Russia. This has become apparent since it has also emerged that there is a deal between the U.S. and India to jointly produce jet fighter engines. The goal? To wean off New Delhi off arms purchases from Russia. Another aim of the U.S. to use India as a counterweight to China. Another strategy that the U.S. is using to lure countries away from Russia are threats. And it has used this against African countries vis-a-vis the Ukraine war. The U.S. actually sent an envoy to Africa to tell these countries the impact of Russia's war on food and energy prices, which have hit developing countries hardest.
He told African governments that the U.S. is trying to do everything it can to reduce the costs that they are facing due to this war. And they should be asking Russia to do the same. In other words, reduce their support for Russia. And finally, the U.S. has planned a campaign to attract Russian scientists and engineers to the U.S. in an effort to further weaken Russia's science and technology base. And the budget to get this going is a healthy one, part of a $33 billion supplemental spending bill. This will help Russia with the possibility of having U.S. scientific organizations to hire them directly rather than return home to Russia when their normal visas expire. And that does it for this quick take section. If you have any comments or questions, contact information is coming up. U.S. efforts to alienate Russia and to stop it from generating revenues has had limited impact. And in some cases, they have backfired. Look at how countries are ditching the dollar since the U.S. confiscated Russia's dollar denominations. The rejection of many countries to U.S. offers also shows that the U.S. is running a bankrupt foreign policy, and its approach does not have much support. That does it for this edition of the program. Thank you so much for tuning in to us, especially the ones who do that weekly. From Mikhail Tavley and the team at Economic Divide, it's goodbye until the next program.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
America's central bank, the U.S. Federal Reserve, has raised interest rates at least 10 times since March of 2022 in order to lower inflation. But according to a recent survey, the move has taken a toll on the wallets of many Americans. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster NBC News has covered this story and tells us more. The U.S. Federal Reserve announced on Wednesday, 26th of July, it has raised its key interest rate by 0.25 percentage point to as much as 5.5%, the highest level in the past 22 years, as it continues to fight persistent inflation in the U.S. economy. Though U.S. officials claim consumer prices have declined for 12 straight months in June, economists say consumer prices increased 3% year on year. They said even though that's the lowest the annual inflation rate has been in more than 2 years, it's still too high for the Federal Reserve, which is looking to wrestle it down to about 2%. By raising its interest rate, the U.S. Federal Reserve hopes to make borrowing and investing more expensive, thereby reducing overall demand for goods, services, and labor in the economy. That effort can put the economy on a path towards a recession, depending on a number of factors, But the U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell has said from the beginning of the central bank's rate hiking campaign that even though there are no guarantees, he intended to avoid such an outcome. After Wednesday's interest rate announcement, he claimed the central bank no longer expects a recession to occur as a result of the increases, adding that it could bump up the key interest rate even further.